While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to all our listeners across the country and, of course, beyond the borders of Namibia. Thank you for tuning in to Eagle FM, at the home of informed conversations and credible national dialogue. I am your host, Nafa Happy Juju, and you are tuned into On The Read News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. Now, the program where these headlines are examined within their full national, social, and economic context. It is Wednesday, the 11th of February, 2026. And as Namibia navigates the early weeks of the new year, public focus remains firmly on issues of governance, of accountability, and of economic resilience, as well as community well-being. Of course, decisions are being taken at this stage and not only shaping immediate realities, but also influencing the country's long-term development path. Now, right here on the radar, we go beyond surface level reporting. We unpack policy decisions, interrogate their implications, and examine how national developments translate into the everyday lived experiences of Namibians, that is, from urban centers to remote rural communities. Now, in a media landscape increasingly shaped by speed and competing narratives, On the Radar remains committed to depth, to balance, and clarity. Now, our approach prioritizes context-driven analysis that connects policy, power, and the people. And that is from 1300 hours to 1430, Monday to Friday. We bring you expert insight, informed perspectives, and community voices. Journalism that seeks not only to inform you, but to strengthen a meaningful public dialogue as well. Now, you can listen via all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app and stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates. Now, wherever you're listening from, whether you're picking up the kids from school, or you're at work, or on the road, or at home, stay with us as we examine the issues shaping Namibia's present and influencing its future. Let's get right into today's top stories. Yesterday, the Japan Green Project was launched at a critical time when Namibia continues to experience the worsening effects of climate change, particularly prolonged droughts that threaten food security, rural livelihoods, and economic stability. The initiative focused on strengthening the resilience of small-scale and subsistence farming communities that are most vulnerable to the climate shocks. Recurrent droughts have severely reduced crop yields and weakened livestock productivity and increased dependency on food aid, especially in arid and semi-arid regions. Now, through the promotion of adaptive and climate-smart agricultural practices, the project aims to equip farmers with practical tools and knowledge to sustainably manage limited water resources, improve soil health, diversify crops, and adopt drought-tolerant farming methods. Now, these interventions are designed not only to protect livelihoods, but also to ensure long-term food security. The project further emphasizes capacity building and knowledge transfer that help enable farmers or farming communities to respond proactively to climate risks rather than reactively relying on emergency relief. Now, by integrating innovation, local knowledge, and sustainable land management practices, the initiative supports Namibia's broader goals of climate adaptation, rural development, and agricultural sustainability. The Japan Green Project reflects continued cooperation between Namibia and Japan in addressing development challenges, reinforcing shared communities to resilience building, environmental sustainability, and inclusive economic growth. Let's now take a listen to FAO representative who was speaking yesterday at the event, as the Ministry of Agriculture was also in attendance. And yeah, let's take a listen to him, and after that we'll come and hear from the minister herself.
It's a great pleasure for everyone to join me today. one of the projects enhancing resilience for farming communities affected by drought through the promotion of adaptive agriculture. And what do we mean by adaptive agriculture? This is continuously adjusting farming practice in order to build the resilience against climate change, market fluctuation, as well as environmental safety. Today's event marks an important step forward from commitment to implementation following the successful signing of this project on December 5th, 2025. Ladies and gentlemen, Namibia continues to face climate droughts, increasing climate variability and growing pressure on food security and rural livelihoods. These challenges underscore the urgent need to move beyond short-term responses towards sustainable, efficient, inclusive, and adaptive solutions. This project presents a response directly to the needs by supporting interventions on adaptive agriculture to strengthen capacity of vulnerable communities and farmers to withstand climate and heat shocks. With the general support of the government of Japan, the interventions are expected to reach 6,000 beneficiary farmers, with emphasis on the inclusion of women and youth-led workers, representing approximately 24,000 people in five regions of Otozantupa, Omaeke, Kunene, Eromo, and Arda. The emphasis on the inclusion of women and youth reflects a shared commitment on inclusion, livelihood diversification, and long-term food security across our level. The project combines a practical livelihood support with strong capacity development to be delivered through the government essential services, with next stocking support, technical support from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. This modality of working through the extension services has proven and delivered a good result in the past, especially with three projects that we were implemented with support from the government of Japan. By reaching out to farmers using the extension services, because they have the maximum speech that is needed by the farmers, and in order to reach the gap between scientific research and practical applications in the field. This model, communities will benefit from climate smart technologies such as solar power irrigation system, hydroponic treatment structures, and other water saving solutions. At the same time, 60 extension officers of the ministry will be trained in climate smart agriculture and good agricultural practices, using proven crop field school and small water agricultural empowerment and promotion approach in close collaboration with China. Most importantly, the project is expected to strengthen national and regional drought response and early and anticipatory detection implementation by enhancing food security monitoring, vulnerability assessment, supporting development of education systems, drought resistant agriculture, and development of regional specific drought protection plan. The steps are critical for reducing human and economic cost of future drought. Furthermore, FAO appreciates the strong collaboration with the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Labor Reform, working through existing government systems to reach communities and farmers effectively and efficiently through extension services. We further value the existing structures which involve regional governments, constituent councillors, traditional authorities, and community leaders, whose leaders will ensure smooth and timely implementation of this project. This locally tailored approach allows FAO to deliver timely, evidence-based support and achieve better impact-driven results. The same partnership model will underpin the implementation of this Japan project, ensuring coordinated action ecological level, and that interest for farming communities throughout the world. Ladies and gentlemen, this project builds on a long and successful partnership between FAO, the government of the Republic of Namibia, and the government of Japan. And from 2022 to this end, the government of Japan, in collaboration with FAO, has committed over $5.1 million to support Namibia's emergency response, drought mitigation, food security, and climate resilience building efforts. The current project is $3 million, and cumulatively, we are saying that over $5.1 million, because $2.1 million was already committed in the past three projects that has been already implemented. FAO remains fully committed to providing technical support and ensuring effective coordination and working closely with the national institution. In conclusion, I wish to express FAO's sincere appreciation to the government of Japan for its continued trust and support, and to the government of the Republic of Namibia for its leadership and commitment. Together, we are investing not only to base needs, but in transforming Namibia's agri-food system to make it more efficient, inclusive, resilient, and sustainable, driven by the four vectors: better production, better nutrition, a better environment, and a better life for all, leaving no one behind. Thank you.
Now let's pause here for now, and we'll be back with other news. Stay tuned.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutete okoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwala. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Okwene ushendi fenawa nukumona oijewa ili nawa. Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa, vera hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Welcome back. Now in other news, the government of the Republic of Namibia has officially signed a headquarters agreement with the Global Water Partnership Organization, also known as GWPO, formally establishing the organization's headquarters in Namibia. Now the agreement was signed by the Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, that is Inge Zamani, and Mr. Alex Simalambo. Mr. Alex Simalambwe, Executive Secretary of the Global Water Partnership Organization. The signing marked a significant milestone for Namibia's water governance sector and positioned the country as a regional hub for water resource management and cooperation by hosting the GW PO headquarters, Namibia strengthened its role in advancing sustainable water management, climate resilience, and transboundary water cooperation across Africa. The Global Water Partnership Organization is an international network that supports countries in the sustainable management of water resources. It works closely with governments, regional institutions, development partners, and civil society in order to promote integrated water resource management, particularly in response to climate change, reoccurring droughts, and growing water demand. Now, for Namibia, one of the driest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, water security remains a national priority. The establishment of the GWPO headquarters is expected to enhance technical cooperation, strengthen policy coordination, and attract international experts and partnerships aimed at improving water access, conservation efforts, and infrastructure development. Officials describe the agreement as a strategic achievement that elevated Namibia's international standing and reaffirms its commitment to sustainable development and regional collaboration in safeguarding water resources. Now, let's take a listen to Mr. Munashe Mungwala, who is the Vice Board Chairperson of the Global Water Partnership Southern Africa.
It is an honor to address you this morning on behalf of the Global Water Partnership Southern Africa, and on behalf of our esteemed chair, His Excellency Dr. Jakaya Kikwete, the former President of the United Republic of Tanzania. His Excellency conveyed his deep regret on being unable to attend this important occasion in person due to pressing commitments. However, he expressly requested the GWPSA board secretariat and partners here in Namibia to be present and fully engaged, recognizing the strategic importance of today's event, not only for Namibia, but for the future direction of the Global Water Partnership as a whole. We are grateful to the government of and people of Namibia for hosting this occasion and for the confidence demonstrated in positioning Namibia as the home of the Global Water Partnership Organization. This is a decision that speaks to leadership, trust, and long-term vision. Today marks more than just the signing of a headquarters agreement. It marks a strategic positioning, as might have heard from the predecessor in their speech. And important to note, it's not a coincidence. In 1996, the first global meeting of the Global Water Partnership was convened here in Namibia. That meeting laid the foundation for a global movement which is built on cooperation, integration, and recognition that water is central to development outcomes across all sectors. Nearly three decades later, we return to not simply to honor history, but to re-anchor global water leadership at a time when water challenges are intensifying, financing gaps are widening, and delivery must be accelerated. For Southern Africa, this moment is deeply historic and significant. GWPSA has worked consistently to translate global principles to regional and national action, supporting countries to strengthen governance, manage shared waters, respond to climate risks, and increasingly to drive the much-needed investment. Within Southern Africa Development Community Region, we work with regional institutions and member states to strengthen transboundary water governance and align water priorities with regional development and investment frameworks. Our focus is clear: moving from policy to delivery, supporting bankable programs, coordinated financing, and practical implementation pathways that enable water to underpin resilience, economic growth, and regional integration. Here in Namibia, this approach is evident through our engagement in the Kunene Kuvelai basins under the Kuvkin program, implemented with the support of the United Nations Development Program and the Global Environment Facility. This work strengthens transboundary cooperation, builds institutional resilience, and supports climate-responsive water management in one of the region's most sensitive and strategic shared systems. This is the kind of work that goes to the heart of what the GWP network must increasingly deliver. That's practical transboundary cooperation, strong, capable institutions, and investment-ready pathways that respond to real risks faced by communities and economies. Anchoring the Global Water Partnership Organization in Namibia strengthens the link between global strategy and regional delivery. It reinforces the principle solutions must be shared close to where water insecurity is most acute, while remaining globally connected and coordinated. It also sends a clear signal that the Global South is not peripheral to global water leadership, that it is central to shaping priorities, mobilizing investment, and delivering results aligned with SDG 6, as you heard from the former speaker, and Africa's water vision in general. Namibia's hosting of the GWPO creates a platform for deeper cooperation, stronger partnerships, and a renewed focus on implementation, bridging ambition with action. We don't believe in talk shows. We believe in results-oriented work. As GWPSA, we see this moment as an opportunity to strengthen alignment across the network, elevate regional experience into global strategy, and accelerate progress where it matters most. In closing, we acknowledge and commend the leadership being provided by GWPO during this transformative period. As a region, we stand firmly supportive and engaged, and we welcome the continued evolution and strengthening of our organization. Let this occasion be remembered not only for where it took place, but for what it set in motion. It is capable of transforming the region, the continent, into a tree of life, like we heard from our national anthem. So it should be more connected, it should be more grounded, it should be more delivered, focused as a partner. I thank you.
Now we hear from Pierre Peterson, that is the Global Water Partnerships Senior Advisor, to talk on the evolution and strategy of the Global Water Partnership Organization.
As a matter of fact, I had the privilege of working for GWP when it became an intergovernmental organization back in 2002. It was formed by 8 countries and 2 international organizations and hosted by the country I come from, Sweden. And it was significant for such an organization, a network, a global network, to become an intergovernmental organization. But today, this occasion, to me, is even more significant. And I really thank the government of Namibia and the president, the minister, for moving forward to host GWPO, the intergovernmental organization. I say this because If I am correctly informed, Namibia has the lowest rainfall of all sub-Saharan countries in Africa. I think Namibia is also very well placed to address the key challenges relating to water. The cost of extreme weather events is growing as climate change is accelerating. Many African countries spend up to 9% of their annual GDP to deal with these costs. Other challenges are use of groundwater resources, and Namibia relies on groundwater resources and the challenges of using them wisely. A third area, which has been mentioned by others already, is transboundary water resources management, increasing competition for the water resource at that level. Namibia is one of few countries that actually mention the importance of dealing with what natural resources in its constitution. So to conclude, I don't think there is any other country in the world that is better placed than Namibia to host the GWP.
Fall in love with the best prices at WB. Get 500 gram Bokomo cornflakes for $31.99. 2 kg nice rice for only $34.99. 1.5 kg real good mixed chicken portions for $79.99. And 10 kg Bokomo fat cook flour for just $137.99. See more February specials at furmanbrock.com. We care.
To host the GWP. So to me, today, it feels like coming home. This is the rightful home of this organization. During the last 30 years, GWP has promoted and helped countries to implement integrated water resource management. A lot has been achieved, and I think most countries, if not all countries, have moved in a positive direction to establish integrated water resources management, IWRM. But with today's challenges, with the accelerating climate change, which impacts water more than any other aspect. There is either too much water or too little water, floods and droughts. So IWRM is not enough on its own. As a matter of fact, a few months ago, there was an independent evaluation of GWP's implementation of its strategy for the period 2020 to 2025. It concluded that GWP has delivered on its mandate. It also concluded that GWP is a unique organization in the institutional architecture of the water sector with its multi-stakeholder partnerships. So we have to build on that and address the new challenges. And during the last year, the visionary CEO, Alex Simalabwe, has led the organization in a transformation process. So the focus in the future will be to help countries to raise access and implement water investments. I think the World Bank talked about the need of $140 billion per year in water investment. EIB said it's probably the double. And So there is a huge need for that. And that is the focus of the GWP in the future. The transformation process also means a decentralization of technical support through continental technical hubs, and also a reformation of the governance setup. So the approach has been embodied in a strategy, a new strategy for GWP for the period 2026 to 2030. And we would now look at a video that explains what that strategy is all about. Thank you very much.
The establishment of the Global Water Partnership Organization, that is GWPO headquarters in Namibia, carries significant strategic importance for both the country and the African continent. For Namibia, it positions the country as a continental hub for water governance and resource management, strengthening its role in shaping regional and international water policy discussions. Now, as one of the driest countries in sub-Sahara Africa, Namibia stands to benefit directly from enhanced access to technical expertise, stronger collaboration on drought response and climate adaptation, and improved alignment with global best practices in water management. Now, the presence of the headquarters may also attract international partnerships, funding opportunities, and institutional capacity building, while boosting Namibia's diplomatic profile and economic activity through conferences and regional engagements. And for Africa, on the other hand, hosting the GWPO headquarters on the continent reinforces African ownership of water solutions and policy direction. It provides a central platform to coordinate sustainable water management strategies tailored to the continent's realities, including recurring droughts, climate change pressures, and growing water demand. Now, the headquarters can also play a critical role in strengthening transboundary water cooperation among countries that share major river basins, thereby supporting regional stability and development. Ultimately, the move signals a commitment to climate resilience, sustainable development, and collective action in safeguarding of one of Africa's most vital resources, or water resources. And now let's take a listen to Global chairperson of the GWPO, Pablo, who's also the Minister of Infrastructure based in Argentina. Now, he couldn't actually make it himself, so another person who is a chair spoke on his behalf. After that, we'll come and listen to the minister.
My name is Jay Kang So. I am currently the chair of the GWP Technical Committee. The technical committee was there from the very beginning of GWP. In fact, it preceded the creation of GWPO. And it is a great pleasure for me to be back in Namibia on this auspicious occasion this morning. The first time I was in Namibia was about 30 years ago as a member of the World Bank team assessing infrastructure options for this beautiful country. And at that time, every country in the world, was worried about how they would finance and build the trillions of dollars of infrastructure that's needed for citizens to thrive, for cities to grow, and countries to prosper. But I would say that in the 30 years that has passed since then, the biggest lesson from the World Bank was that, in fact, the key to providing successful infrastructure services was not the building or the construction, but the knowledge that it takes to operate and maintain and deliver services for citizens. And I think that theme is very important to GWP. While infrastructure has improved more or less in countries all over the world in the past 30 years, in fact, water and the challenge of water security you could argue, has even gotten worse. Impacts from climate change has threatened water security, and water security is a concern for every country in the world, whether in the global north or global south. My country, South Korea, is a good example of a country that is facing severe water challenges. When I was born, South Korea was one of the poorest countries in the world, and water security was among one of our key challenges. My country is a beautiful country of mountains, but what that means is that whenever it rained, everything goes straight down the mountain, straight into the ocean. So retaining water for the population was one of our country's first challenges for the government. But as South Korea developed our water security, it was also able to provide a sustained source of water for industries to develop. Economists in South Korea say that if we had not been able to achieve a sustained source of water for industries, South Korea would not have been able to develop its semiconductor industry and its economic prosperity. They call South Korea a miracle on the Han River, and I believe that it's a good example of how water security also creates incredible prosperity and economic growth for countries. These are the themes that GWP believes are so important for every country and every member of our global, unique intergovernmental organization. And I am so delighted that we will be launching the GWPO global headquarters of Namibia in Namibia today. Namibia's own journey in water security is well known, and its knowledge base, the lessons learned and challenges, will be a great knowledge, source of knowledge for all of the GWP members. In fact, we have GWP, a tech member, here today already ready to sign a knowledge partnership with the Technical University of Namibia. So we are starting running on the ground. And as many speakers have said today, this is not GWP's first engagement in Namibia. So I would like to conclude my remarks by introducing a welcome and video from the first chair of GWP's technical.
Now, speaking also at the event is the minister herself, who was very appreciative of GWPO, that is Minister Inge Zamani, Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform. She said this signing is a strategic commitment, a shared vision and a decision step forward in global water governance, anchored firmly in the global south. And Namibia is one of the driest countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Water scarcity is not an abstract concept for us. It is a lived reality that shapes our development choices, our infrastructure investments, and our diplomacy. Precisely because of this reality, Namibia has a long understood that water is the foundation for economic growth, human dignity, peace, and resilience. Let's take a listen to the minister herself.
We can develop agents of change who can drive transformation in their communities. The impact of the program extends far beyond the immediate beneficiaries. When we strengthen one household, we uplift the entire community. When communities thrive, our nation prospers. For this president, the excellency, Dr. Wole Soyinka, have said, we are too few to be. And that's not a slogan, it's real. Once we empower one household in one village, we are extending the empowerment to that level. If we empower two, the multiple effects, the multiplier effects is even more. So let us continue to promote interventions that strengthen households. And by so doing, we uplift the entire community. We have already heard the program includes the provision of agro inputs.
the distribution of small livestock. I don't know why they is only limited to small livestock. I hope that the midterm review will also say it's necessary for some regions, like Kunene and Eroko. The last 7 years of drought has completely decimated all the livestock in those regions. I had the privilege to visit those both regions in November, in December last year. And as we were driving around, I saw large crops. But there were no cattle, there was nothing. So I asked, where are the cattle? I see the crops, but I don't see the cattle. I asked the chief, when I went, I was in the machete, and I asked Darona one ago when I was in Kunene, and I was told that the animals died from the drought. Completely, the crops are closed. So, if we want to expand this program, we must also seriously consider also large livestock, because the large livestock has more value than the small livestock, and there's more market than the small livestock. So the program designers, our FAO technical advisor, please let us look at what else we can do to support farmers who have traditionally come up with large livestock. One of the key pillars of the program is also the deployment of solar power irrigation systems, hydroponics, and shade net structures. This technology has not only increased productivity, but also conserve water and enhance resilience to extreme weather events. By modernizing our agricultural practices, we are equipping our farmers to adapt, innovate, and succeed at what they do best. I tell you, the farmers know what they do, what they want to do, and how they want to do it. There is nobody who knows better than the farmer himself. So as our extension officers interact with the farmers, let the farmers advise you how they want to develop their programs. Listen to them, take their advice, because they know what they are doing, they have done it. Their ancestors have done it before. It's passed on from generation to generation. Do something that you just start. If you were ever an agriculturalist, very few people would want to go into a sector where they have no connection. If you were not a daughter of a fisherman, you have no connection to want to become a fisherwoman. But because you are connected, you know your mother or your father were fishermen, you are likely to be one. Or to encourage somebody in your family to take on that heritage. Honorable Governor, building resilience requires more than immediate intervention. It demands strong systems, effective preparedness, and a commitment to sustainability. As part of the efforts to ensure the sustainability of this program, the integration and sustainability, and I like the focus of this program, it says enhancing resilience of farming. We are enhancing, we are not developing, we are not building. That recognizes that they know that they have to farm in a sustainable way, and our intervention is just to help them to push forward to enhance their resilience. As part of those efforts, we are developing 5 regional drought action plans, tailored to local conditions and informed by the best available data. These plans, Honorable Governors, will enable us to respond proactively to droughts, minimize the impact, and protect our vulnerable communities.
Furthermore, as part of this program, we are strengthening our food security information system and early warning mechanism. This is very, very important that we know what is the likely harvest that you're going to be harvesting countrywide and from where. How much do we need to put in our strategic food reserves? And how much is required in the event of emergency? You know, during COVID, somebody said during the earlier session that we had to import a lot of our food because we're not prepared. Our strategic food reserve, regrettably, are sitting at less than 20%. Less than 20%. So we must work harder. According to the standards of the FAO, your strategic food reserve must be able to feed your population at least for a minimum of 8 months before you can be running out of food. But currently what we have is not enough to feed us for more than 3 months in the event of an emergency. We have to work together for the farmers to produce, for AFDA to buy, and for us to feed our strategic reserves. And so this program is aiming towards enhancing and strengthening our information system and early warning mechanism. Because this is essential for effective decision making, for resource allocation, and for community mobilization. As I conclude, let me reiterate the key messages that emanated from our discussion today. And two that stood out for me is that partnership and leadership are the bedrock of our progress. And through our combined efforts, with the support of the Japanese government and our technical partner, the FAO, the regional leadership in the 5 selected regions led by you, Honorable Governors, we are forging a path towards a more secure and resilient Namibia. Our circumstances are challenging. Namibia is one of the most arid countries in the sub-Saharan Africa. We know that. We know that our rain patterns are erratic. But our collective resolve should be unwavering. Through targeted support, innovative interventions, and strong systems, we are creating opportunities for our farmers to thrive. And when our farmers are thriving, Namibia will thrive. Our contribution as a sector to our GDP will increase. I cannot stop without raising one serious risk that we are facing as a sector. It will be unwise of me to conclude as if everything is okay and what we're doing here is going to take what we have. We have a severe threat of the foot and mouth disease coming from the first time from our southern neighbor. All along the trail has been coming from the northeast. But this time is approaching us from the south. And it has also crept into our eastern neighbor, which is Botswana, on the northern side of the waters, the Zimbabwe. So this means that as farmers, whether you are a livestock farmer or a horticulture farmer, we must be highly alert. The protection also starts at the baseline. So when people are coming to your farm, and you know that those people were last week, somewhere there in the northern side of the tunnel, make sure that you take the precautions. When the trucks are coming to the auctions and you are taking your livestock for auction,
make sure we ask those that are responsible for organizing those bushes that the trucks that are being used to collect the imports from our farms are fully protected, have been sprayed, and in no way near a zone that is affected by the food and mouth. I'll be making a statement next week about the measures that we are planning, and we have been planning the efforts that we have put in already and that we are going to be putting in to defend our borders from the south. Particularly, people are saying there were all blue zone fences across the country, and we must renew that and strengthen them. But we are saying let us start where the war is near and the threat is imminent. That's in the Kalas region. First, protect that, and then you move upwards and create barrier zone and reinforce those zones that we have. So, we are not saying this in order to create panic amongst the farmers. We want to raise awareness and heighten our alert that we really have this threat, and I'm sure you are following events as they are occurring. A lot of news on the social media, on the print media, and on the international channels. We must support our South African neighbors also, because if they are able to control it then the threat is less minimized. So we must work together, we must support each other, because after all, we are one Sahel region. And whenever a threat is within the Sahel region, it's a threat to all of us. So I just wanted to say before I conclude that we must be alert towards the real danger that we are facing a war against the food and mouth disease. And in closing, therefore, I say that once again, my deepest appreciation to all our partners and our stakeholders. To all of you who have sacrificed your Saturday to be here with us today. And to the Japanese government, through Ambassador, for your continued support and in financing our agricultural sector development. We haven't started today, but this is not the end of our offer support. We highly appreciate that. We also want to acknowledge and thank the FAO, Mr. Makopi. Your organization is a real partner to us. I personally look at you as my technical advisor insofar as agriculture is concerned. Thank you very much for helping to build the capacity. Please continue to do so. Your efforts in transforming lives and building a stronger Namibia to make sure that we can win the war against poverty, against food insecurity, and against food importation. And this is what I wanted to say. Together we can achieve lasting food security, climate resilience, and prosperity for all.
Minister Inge Zamane speaking also say that through the headquarters agreement being signed today, Namibia commits to providing an enabling environment for the Secretariat, including appropriate office infrastructure, administrative and logistical support, visa and residency facilitation, tax and customs exemptions for official operations, and a stable legal framework aligned with international hosting standards. I don't know about y'all, but this right here, I think, is one of the many reasons why investors would consider bringing their investment or putting their money where a country really appreciates them and gives them the platform to do the work for the benefit of the Namibian people and for the benefit of Africa as a whole, without interference and making it very easy for them. We're talking about tax and customs exemptions for official operations. Now, she said those commitments reflect Namibia's understanding that effective global institutions require not only vision, but also predictable and supportive operating conditions. Now, the hosting of the GWPO Secretariat in Namibia carries significance far beyond its Namibian borders. It forms part of an innovative dual headquarters model. And she further said it is a powerful signal of change in global governance as it reaffirms Africa's role not only as a recipient of solutions, but also as a co-architecture of global policy, investment and delivery platforms. You know, Africa needs to be involved in all this because we understand better. We know we need the assistance. We know where it's rigging. We know what is what. So we know the challenges better. And therefore those that are bringing the solutions or assisting in bringing the solutions need to work closely with the people on ground. Nonetheless, let's pause right here. This is On the Read and News Analysis. Do stay tuned. We pause here. Take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Our studio line, however, is open 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Please come through your opinions or contributions right here on the radar. I'll see you after the commercial break.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle
FM, the eye. Okupitira mo Eagle FM, otuna ebitoda njuka, okukwetira oipindi konu konda doini nawa. Nune udo, otukwetira o special, getashia kengejefa omarudi dayo loka, opone ushendife nawa, nukumona oijewairi nawa, ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM, onore tatu imwe bali heari, nola natu heari bali no heari ile konderewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, omafilane Eagle FM, the eye.
Enough for news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa, where the Johannesburg mayor is giving an update on water challenges.
Let's turn our focus now to Joburg, where the Joburg mayor, Dada Morero, is set to give an update on the water supply challenges that the city faces. That briefing has just started. Let's take you there.
Today zero, but yes, for people that have not had water at all, logically, it would mean they've been at day zero. So we need to make sure that we look at those areas, sort those areas that have been adversely affected, ensure that we can pick up. And I think the weather is not also insisting in terms of the heat wave, and people are consuming more water. So we need to ensure that we pick up MD and the team. We have also taken a decision this morning that we will be visiting all the depots, meeting with the actual engineers on the grounds, technicians on the ground, to understand what the gravity of the challenges that we have, so that we can resolve this thing. But we are also saying to our communities, especially in the townships, in areas like Alexander, Soweto, Orange Farm, they continue to build illegal structures that are not approved, and some of the structures are built right on top of the infrastructure and we're unable to access some of the valves that we need to access to ensure that there's a continuous free flow of water in those areas. So that is part of what we are doing in this campaign as we are engaged with stakeholders. We have engaged with stakeholders in the Parkmore, Parkhurst areas last week, to engage with them on what has happened. So I had very successful engagements with ratepayers associations. Last week, Thursday, I was in Soweto. On Wednesday, we are continuing with stakeholder engagement. And there's also closed meetings with stakeholders where we actually give them all the facts of what is happening, what budgets are we putting in place, what are the future plans that we will be doing, and we'll probably plan a further media engagement just on the future plans of what we're investing and what we are doing to resolve the water issues in Johannesburg for the longest of time. So, Peggy, you'd find that the system is not supplied from the same system. So you may be in Chawela, but your area might be probably supplied from a commando system or some system, and the other people are supported from a particular system. So that is why you'll find that you're in the same ward, others have water, others don't have water. It's an infrastructure issue on where are you supplied from. But he will know the real technical issues, what supplies Chawela. Well, the minister can wash her hands. I don't know if she did say that. Mhlambe kathethanga isiXhosa to try and explain it in Xhosa. But the minister has been hands-on in the Joburg issue. This morning at 6:30, I was in the meeting with the minister, putting the necessary support to ensure that Joburg does not experience water challenges. She's now boarding a flight. She's hopeful to get a flight at around 2. She wants to be here as I engage with community meetings this afternoon. So from the ministers and the deputy minister, they've been hands-on, giving us all the necessary support in Joburg. So, and as Babegatin, but I guess it may show any interview because she's really, really hands-on in Joburg. And not only in Joburg, in the Gauteng. In fact, the government of the province, the MEC for COCTA, on a weekly basis, we've got war room meetings with the MEC, Randwater attends, ourselves and all other municipalities, so that we can crack the problem, have solutions, and sustain the solutions that we have had. We are not communicating sufficiently. The media people have been saying it. Communities have been saying that our communication is not sufficient. Yes, it is there, but it's not sufficient. So we must improve. Perhaps you'll give me ideas as media people on how to better the communication. But we are trying through these press conferences, media releases, stakeholder engagements, and public meetings. But I'll welcome an advice from experts, Alex, on how we can improve on the communication.
Standard Bank's annual economic outlook. Let's take a listen.
Africa lifted towards the end of last year following an upgrade to the country's sovereign credit rating. Standard Bank Group Chief Economist Ghulam Palim says the outlook remains positive with the potential for further upgrades over the next 2 years.
They're not going to come hurriedly or immediately, but certainly positive outlooks, we think, amongst the rating agencies will befall South Africa with the hint of further credit rating upgrades over, as I say, the next 24 months.
Palim notes, however, that the political climate remains a concern, citing coalition stability, progress in reforms, and the country's water woes. Positively, employment is edging higher, offering another signal that the economy may be stabilizing.
Employment is edging higher. In 2023, the employment level surpassed the pre-COVID highs. And now we have 16 million people unemployed and continuing to increase. Again, on its own, this is not a single vector of overarching thrust. But what it does do is inject some level of stability into households, some level of income security, and also helps to solidify credit spending in an economy.
Meanwhile, Balim points out that stronger economic performance and lower interest rates could ease the fiscal burden, making planned tax hikes less likely as this year's budget approaches.
The Reserve Bank could further lower interest rates this year. The real repo rate, meaning the nominal repo rate of the Reserve Bank minus next year's inflation, is still fairly high, and therefore urging and encouraging the Reserve Bank to the proclivity for lower rates.
While growth is expected to be modest, Balim says South Africa's economy has the strongest promise and prospects it has seen in 10 years. Nosipho Radebe, SABC News, Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, South Africa's domestic airline market is flourishing.
South Africa's domestic aviation market remains one of the largest on the continent, with industry estimates suggesting roughly 30 to 50,000 passengers fly within the country every single day. Low-cost carrier FlySafair currently dominates the domestic market, controlling up to 60% of seat capacity, while Air Link and South African Airways compete for the remaining share. The scale of domestic air travel highlights aviation's critical role in supporting business travel, tourism, and economic connectivity across the country's major cities.
And hopefully with the economy going the way that it is, the little bit of growth and the sort of strength of the rand at the moment, that definitely bodes well for a little bit of opportunity for us to continue to grow. So it's pretty good from a low cost perspective.
There remains a shortage of seat supply compared to demand, according to aviation analyst Dr. Guy Leach, which has resulted in increased profit margins for the first time in many years.
Overall, the situation is one of deregulation since 1991, and intense competition amongst the local carriers, so much so that we've seen a huge mortality rate in local carriers. I mean, I don't need to mention the loss of airlines like Comair, Kalula, One Time, Mango, and so on. So the margins have been so tight in the industry for so long that you've really got to be a good operator to succeed.
The balance between what that demand is and what the supply is has been in play for a while, so we're seeing reasonable prices that we can work with, which is good, so it's sustainable for the industry.
Air Link is one of the South African airline industry success stories and continues to add more flights to the already established route network, and with plans to expand that further into the African continent.
What we need to do to continue growing our aspect of the market is concentrate on delivering frequency of services, with the availability that meets the market's requirements, rather than overcapacitate the market and create an unsustainable situation. But timing is extremely important, and the timing is important because of the multiple facets of the market's demand.
So price, seat availability, time of flights, and then the ability to feed and defeed your flights is also absolutely critical components in the choice or selection of an airline.
The airline business in South Africa has been through its highs and lows over the past decade. Several airlines have been grounded permanently, while the national carrier has bounced back in style, turning a profit after a bumpy business rescue ride. While due to increased demand, new airlines have taken flight, but only a handful have navigated the turbulent times. C.S. du Plessis, CGTN, Johannesburg.
$15 million jobs are needed annually to absorb Africa's youth.
Zoom out for a continental picture now. African countries need to create 15 million jobs a year by 2030 if they are to fully absorb the millions of young Africans coming into the job market every year. A study by the World Data Lab in collaboration with the University of Cape Town and the Mastercard Foundation, which is due to be launched in the next 9 hours, is pointing out a curious paradox. On one hand, young Africans start working way too early, but the vast majority of them are trapped in low-paid, insecure work in the informal sector. One in three, in fact, still live pretty much in extreme poverty. Now, Dr. Wolfgang Fengler is the founder and the CEO of World Data Lab. When we spoke earlier today, we explored why decades of growth rates of around 5% have still not translated into quality jobs that millions of Africa's young require.
The key message is that actually Africans, many young Africans work. They have no choice. So it's a misconception that there's an underemployment in Africa. It's actually, could almost argue, overemployment compared to other countries and regions, because in other countries and regions, young people often also go more to school or to university. And so what does working poverty mean? It either means you're working in rural areas on the farm of parents. The share of agriculture employment among youth is still surprisingly high. So many don't have the job, kind of job that I have in offices and in the modern economy. And the second is that in services, you have a bifurcation. Some have modern jobs, as you have, but others have like the classic dealer or hustler on the street. That's also a service job. And that's still the reality for most Africans.
Right. So there's two interesting data points in the report so far, because on one hand, there's 9%. I believe I have that number right. 9% of young people who've completed tertiary education of some sort. But as you point out, a lot of young Africans are working way too early, right? So that points, at least to my understanding, that points to a massive reskilling challenge that we have across the continent. How do we fix it?
Well, first of all, these are long-term shifts. And believe it or not, the situation is better than it used to be when I lived in Kenya and we met the first time, and when I first traveled to Kenya in the 90s. So things have been improving in education, and now there's at least 9% tertiary graduates, and there is a substantial chunk of secondary graduates, and they are more competitive in the labor force than they used to be. But as you indicate, there's still such an opportunity to educate and to skill more Africans. It's not just in school, it's also at work, at the job, because learning is now very interactive. It's on the job and in the classroom. And that's what the big opportunity and challenges at the same time, because remember, Africa is the last reservoir of global talent. The world is losing out on young people, 50 million this year, except Africa, and Africa is adding a lot of young people. So the trick will be to convert this demographic opportunity into this demographic dividend.
Care that helps you care for others. That's the Basic Mental Health First Aid course, free for NHP members. You'll learn how to spot early signs of mental or emotional distress in friends, family, or colleagues, and how to guide them to the right support before small struggles become bigger problems. Learn more and register for free at nhp.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Skilling, but skilling, as I said, also happens through jobs and through entrepreneurship.
Speaking of jobs, though, because I know a lot of people look at this report and say, hang on a minute, but a lot of economies in Africa have been growing at least 5% or more every year for the last decade, if you exclude the damage done during the pandemic years. So what is it about those high growth rates that is not translating into the creation of more quality formal sector jobs?
Yeah, well, there's a few angles to highlight there. First, it may feel comforting to have 5% growth, but remember, there is in most countries at least 2% population growth. So in reality, you then got only 3% per capita. And then compared to Asia, it's still low. India is growing at 77% with 1% population growth. So that's then when you get actually the real extra momentum. And what Africa has been weak, and we even talked about it when I was in Kenya, was the manufacturing. It is not catching up on manufacturing, on these opportunities that you would have in low, medium skilled manufacturing in the factories of today and tomorrow, where you could not just be the workbench for the world, but also the workbench for Africa. Ethiopia has made some gains. Kenya has made a few gains, but otherwise it's not a dynamic picture. The opportunity for Africa is in services, it's in software, it's in the field we cover, data science. And if you have those skills, they have the advantage that they are tradable and that you can sell to the world as you sell your show to the world. And that's where I think there's the biggest opportunity.
What is it about manufacturing?
Meanwhile, Nigerian fintech RegTech plans to raise $100 million for expansion.
Let's bring in Emmanuel Ojo, CEO of the fintech firm RegTech, is joining us live on the program tonight. Thank you very much for your time this evening, Mr. Ojo. I want to start with a bit of context for our viewers. CBN data pointed out that there were nearly 11 billion transactions going through the Nigerian interbank settlement system in 2024. That arose around 25% of all electronic transactions in the country. But relative to that, how does RegTech's performance compare over the last 2 years?
Thank you very much. Happy to be here. Now, with regards to your comment, of course, the CBN, the NIBS transactions was about 11 billion in 2024, whereas RegTech Limited's transaction was about 5.3 billion. And the reason for that variance, or should I say performance, of RegTech Limited is simply because RegTech is more focused on interfacing with multiple vertical business verticals. We interface with both bank-led real transactions, we interface with fintechs, we interface with merchants, SMEs, and large corporations, such as telecommunications institutions as well. And so we were able to obviously increase our velocity of transaction, whereas with NIBS, they majorly narrowed down to bank-led transactions.
There was an interesting industry survey from the central bank that came out a couple of weeks ago, which pointed out that about 62.5% of companies said that, you know, the delays in approvals and the ambiguity in guidelines are key challenge for them when it comes to compliance. And granted, I understand you're not here speaking from the industry, but from the perspective of RegTech and the industry as a whole, where do we find that balance between the need for AMLTF compliance without stifling growth?
Well, as you know, the Nigerian market is a growing market. Take, for example, RegTech. Today, we are processing well over $20 billion worth of transaction, which is over 30 trillion and Naira. The ecosystem has significantly grown, and there is need for you for consumers to be well protected by the regulator. Just in 2024, the ecosystem recorded over 1 quadrillion worth of transactions in the digital space. And what I would say in my perspective is that it's a combination of the two ecosystems. I start with the regulators. I would say that the regulator could do a lot of assistance in providing, for instance, machine-readable rules where the requirements that are needed by startups or PSPs, payment solution service providers, are very clear. They could also provide standard approval SLAs that would ensure that within 30 to 60 days, applications can be approved or declined as needed. But I will also advise to the startup companies or the PSPs who are applying for one operating license or the other, that is also good to do adequate research before making the applications. Try to find out what are the required conditions, terms and conditions for you to be eligible for some of the things that you're operating for. Some of the things we've also observed is that there are times when PSPs sometimes request for licenses for initiatives that are not within the statutory categories. So this requires the regulators to do a level of adequate research to be sure that the end consumer can be well protected. In RegTech, right, we benefit from our conglomerates where we have a very high corporate governance and risk discipline. So we are very exposed to multiple business verticals that makes us always eligible for any regulatory operating license that we may require.
Expanding to 29 African countries by January 2027, that's a fairly tight timeline. What are the main regional markets you're looking to get into?
Well, our focus is to first expand to West Africa. And after West Africa, we would also expand to East Africa. And then we would expand to North Africa as well. We've already been able to deploy some of our solutions in West African countries, the Umuah region, for example, where we are currently present in 5 countries. And we are hoping to expand that as a next phase to the East African region. We'll be working closely with local partners and regulators to ensure that we abide by local rules and standards as we make progress.
What are the timelines for the expansion into North Africa and East Africa? Is that something that we should be expecting towards the second half of 2026?
That's correct. Our target is by the second half of the year, which by that time would have made significant progress in our expansion across the continent. We're very focused on how we would ensure that this is done. We will do this through multiple distribution channels within the ecosystems. We would work with aggregators. We will work with regulators. We would integrate to national central switches of multiple countries. One of the things that we'll be providing are single APIs that can provide multiple instances for various businesses.
We've mentioned the figure of the amount of capital that you're looking to raise, $100 million in order to fund that entire expansion plan. Where's the money going to come from? Is it a combination of internally generated resources, external debt, and equity?
Well, it's going to be a healthy capital stack. It will be, what I mean by that, it's going to be a combination of internally generated cash flows, obviously. We would also leverage debt financing, and obviously equity. We are well regulated, and we have a very good discipline when it comes to cash management. And so we believe that a healthy combination of capital generation would help us propel our goals and vision.
With respect to that $100 million figure, how much of that are you looking for in terms of debt and equity?
Well, I would say a large percentage, as much as we can, for equity. Obviously, you and I know that equity is the most affordable means of financing. But we also know that sometimes it takes time before you can generate equity finance. So we would do a combination, as I mentioned. We would still continue to leverage on internally generated cash, and we would use debt financing as we feel that there are urgent needs when needed. But most importantly, for a massive scale of expansion, we are very focused on MSME acceptance solutions, where we want to propel POS solutions, for example, physical collections, virtual collections for MSMEs across the continent. We recognize that there's a growing ecosystem within this space, which is over 600 million SMEs in the continent today. And we believe that we want to be a part of that. We also want to use some of these funds to secure the necessary regulatory permits in multiple African continents. We will need to scale our payment infrastructure to be able to accommodate this transaction. As I mentioned today, our payment infrastructure is currently processing over $20 billion worth of infrastructure. But we know that this is within the Nigerian space, which is of just of a GDP of about 400.
Meanwhile, tariffs threaten the Colombian flower industry amid Valentine's rush.
Millions of Colombian roses arrived in the United States just in time for Valentine's Day. But industry experts worry the world's second largest flower exporter won't survive new economic challenges. Colombia, which trails only the Netherlands in global exports, shipped approximately 65,000 tons of fresh-cut flowers to the U.S. between January 15th and February 9th. The Valentine's season typically accounts for 20% of annual sales, according to the industry group Asoco Flores. But the holiday rush is being overshadowed by a 10% U.S. tariff imposed last April as part of President Donald Trump's broader trade measures. The U.S. accounts for about 80% of Colombia's flower exports. Jose Antonio Restrepo is the manager of a flower producing and trading company near Bogota.
We've been seriously affected. Last year, a 10% tariff, which represents more than $200 million for the industry. On top of that, there's an exchange rate that we haven't seen in many years. And lastly, the minimum wage issue. In a business like flowers, labor accounts for about 60%, and around 85% of our people earn the minimum wage. So we're in very adverse, very difficult circumstances.
He warned that without a shift in economic conditions, the industry could face widespread layoffs and farm closures by this summer. Growers are also battling a peso that has strengthened almost 12% against the dollar over the past year and a 23% rise in minimum wage, factors that are eroding competitiveness and squeezing margins. Flower cultivation employs almost 250,000 workers in Colombia. On the packing floor, Susana Vega said the holiday still brings her a sense of purpose.
An immense joy, knowing that we're bringing happiness to someone. To a woman, to a mother, to someone so admired by a loved one.
y que estamos beneficiándonos a sí mismos nosotros.
And that we're benefiting ourselves as well, and helping a company move forward to overcome many of the challenges that are happening right now. A very beautiful joy.
US-Iran prepares for a second round of nuclear talks.
Iran and the United States held indirect negotiations last week in Oman, focusing on Tehran's nuclear program and sanctions relief. Iranian officials say the talks were mediated and limited in scope, as both sides look ahead to another round of discussions.
Why do we insist so much on enrichment and refuse to give it up, even if a war is imposed on us? Because no one has the right to dictate our behavior. They fear our atomic bomb, while we are not looking for one. Our atomic bomb is the power to say no to the great powers.
Tehran has rejected Washington's demand for zero uranium enrichment, insisting that enrichment is its right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iranian officials also say the country's missile program and regional influence are non-negotiable. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian described the Oman talks as a step forward, saying his administration favors dialogue, but only on the basis of equality and respect.
Any negotiation based on international law, respecting national sovereignty from a position of equality and on the principle of win-win is acceptable and welcomed by us. Our foreign policy is defined by dignified interaction.
Meanwhile, Iran's nuclear chief says technical and political issues are being discussed in parallel, adding that any dilution of 60% enriched uranium would only happen after sanctions are fully lifted. However, many Iranians say they remain pessimistic about negotiations as economic strains continue to take a toll on daily life.
We have no hope in negotiations. Young people have no jobs. My child pays his employees' salaries out of his own pocket. My son and my daughter are unemployed.
This is not the first time we are negotiating. The U.S. is imposing sanctions during negotiations. What kind of game is this? It's just a waste of time. We will gain nothing, and they are playing us.
Despite doubts about diplomacy, many Iranians agree on one point, that Iran's missile program should remain off the negotiating table.
We will never negotiate our missile program. After having so many meteors, we won't do that. It is not negotiable. Our missile program is needed for our deterrence.
While officials framed the Oman talks as progress, sharp differences remain between Tehran and Washington over enrichment, sanctions, and the scope of negotiations. When another round of talks expected soon, many Iranians here say real change will only be measured by economic relief and not only by diplomatic statements. Sefer Salami, CGTN, Tehran.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onko Nanadingi program, brought to you by Loise Shimi.